Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Epochs. Hello and welcome back to Epochs. This episode, I thought what I shall do is continue on with my series all about the British monarchy. Return to that. I feel like it's Epochs bread and butter. Why not return to it? It's been a while now. So let's just pick up the story. If you remember last time we left off, I did a very long series all about the life and career of Henry V. Got all the way up to Henry V's death. So we'll carry on the story from there. So his son, the next king, is Henry VI. You've got Henry IV, V, and VI, all one after the other. Now, I'll have to recap a bit on Henry V and how the whole story was left. Because, if you remember, Henry V was a great martial king, a great warrior king, arguably one of the very, very best we ever had. And he died suddenly. Not a suicide, but he died really quite suddenly. He was in the middle of fighting campaigns in France, doing very, very well. He'd got himself a deal with the King of France to disinherit the Dauphin, the French prince, and that when the old French king, who wasn't long for this world anyway, when he died, the crown of France would pass to him, Henry. Henry V would then be King of France and England. Finally, probably, you would have thought, hopefully, ending the Hundred Years' War, which was longer than 100 years, ultimately, but ending that whole war and just uniting the two crowns in one person. And so everything was set for that, really. And Henry had a son, a baby heir, and he was only like, 9 months old, 10 months old, a tiny little baby in a crib still. And then Henry V, out of nowhere, gets dysentery and dies. Falls ill when within a few weeks of catching something, almost certainly dysentery, a bloody flux, as they called it, dies of that. He just died of it. Now, this is a massive turning point in history, at least in Western European history, Northwestern European history, French and English history. Massive turning point because it was a really inopportune moment to die. Really inopportune. Because it leaves, as I said, a tiny baby as the next king. Not ideal whatsoever. And so it's difficult, isn't it, to see history in any other way that that was a turning point. And we go from the age of Henry V and everything that came before to just a new world, a new beginning, a new chapter. A page has turned in the story. The career of Henry V is cut short, and now we're into the age of Henry VI. Now, this story, the story of Henry VI, is a little bit more complicated than many of the other stories that come before it and after it, because his whole reign, his whole life, his whole story, if you like, is bound up with the end of the Hundred Years' War and the Wars of the Roses. So we're getting into the age of the Wars of the Roses. And it's complicated. It's much more complicated than the life of, say, Henry V, Edward III, Edward I. It's more complicated than that. For example, I hope it's not too much of a spoiler alert. Towards the end of his life, Henry VI, the baby I'm going to start talking about here, when he's grown up, he gets deposed and then reinstated and then deposed again. So it becomes complicated. It's not just a straightforward linear story from start to finish. You can just go through it all chronologically and it's all nice and neat, effectively. No, it's not nice and neat. Sometimes if you look at a king list, the king list of the kings of England, it will just say Henry V, Henry VI, Edward IV, and then onwards. No. There's a whole Wars of the Roses there where it's a back and forth, a real ding-dong back and forth. So the life of Henry VI and the life of the next king, if you like, Edward IV, it's all entwined and mixed up and a mess. It's a mess. So this story will definitely be, if not a mini series, a relatively long series. I don't know how much detail I'm going to do it in, but it will certainly be more than one episode. And so the reign and life and career of Henry VI and the next king, Edward IV, are all mixed up into one. I may even, start calling this series the life of Henry VI and Edward IV, because it's so mixed up. And there's loads of other characters that are really, really important. Loads of other characters. Warwick, the Kingmaker, to name but one. There are loads and loads of other characters. It's really the story, certainly the Wars of the Roses part of it, which I may not even get to in this episode. It's a story of the battle, the fight between the House of York and the House of Lancaster, two entirely different families, and by extension, two entirely different factions in the whole country. It's a civil war. It's basically a civil war. So it gets messy. But at least to begin with, at least the early part of Henry's life, we can just talk about Henry VI for a while, at least. So while it's still nice and neat, we'll keep it that way. But there's loads of other characters to get into, people's wives and other family. I mean, like the Duke of York, Edward IV's father, who never became king himself. He's like really, really important, you see. So there's many, many characters to introduce here. And to do it any justice, you need to go into a fair bit of detail. And so I shall do that. I'll be reading largely from, almost entirely from, Sir Charles Oman, Professor Sir Charles Oman, a late 19th century, early 20th century Oxford historian, one of the best to ever do it, and Sir Winston Churchill, The History of the English-Speaking Peoples. So I'll be reading from those. You know, both date long before wokeism, so we don't have to worry about any of that nonsense revisionism. It's just straight up normal history. I hope you enjoy it. I know I will enjoy talking about this and reading about it. It's one of my favourite periods. And one other spoiler alert to let you know, to sort of keep this in mind, that ultimately, absolutely ultimately, at the end of the Wars of the Roses, long after Henry VI, or a while after Henry VI is dead, we finally end up with Richard III versus Henry VII at the Battle of Bosworth Field in 1485. And Henry VII, Henry Tudor, ends up winning that, of course. And then we've got the Tudor period. So this whole era of Henry VI through Edward IV onto, well, there's a very brief period of Edward V, the little boy, one of the princes in the tower, and then Richard III, and then Henry Tudor. So this whole story really is, in a way, setting up how the Tudors become the royal family. But we'll get into all of that. We've got to talk about Catherine Valois, Catherine of France, in all of that. Okay, well, let's actually start there. Let's say a word or two about that before we dive into the baby Henry VI. Henry V, Henry VI's mother, was Catherine of France. She was the daughter of the old King of France, Catherine of Valois. And she becomes really important in the end for the Tudor story. I'll just cut ahead a bit and tell you about all of this so you can kind of keep it in the back of your mind, I suppose. So she's married to Henry V, a pure political marriage, and has a little baby, of course. And she wasn't married to him for all that long before he dies of dysentery. And she, you know, her little baby is only sort of 9 months old, 10 months old or so when that happens. And you might think, as is often the case, her part in history, you know, medieval times, her part in history is done now. She's simply the king mother, a king mother figure. And she won't have an important role to play beyond that now, right? She, as a character, as a figure in history, will just rescind into the darkness and not really play anymore in the key events. But she does, because what happens is, you know, she is effectively sidelined. She's not that important for sort of power politics and the running of government and wars and things. Okay, she's not important in all that. What she does, she's allowed to go off and sort of live her own life to a degree. And the low resolution version of it is because she's still quite young, very young, really. So she's still got decades and decades to live. What she goes on to do in years after this, many years after this, she falls in love with sort of a nobody. Well, he's not a nobody, but he's just a knight. He's not a prince. He's not a duke. He's not a great earl. He's a Welsh knight. A Welsh knight who went by the name of Owen Tudor, or Owen ap Tudor. Let's just call him Owen Tudor. So he's sort of a nobody, and it's sort of scandalous. To begin with, no one really cares. Like, ultimately, she doesn't really matter. So, you know, let her have her affair. It seems like that's what, in the first instance, what happened. And she has a son by him, Edmund Tudor, okay? And although he's the son of the king mother, so a half-brother to the king, Henry VI, we're about to talk about here, he's his half-brother, he's not in the royal line. Well, not really. There are many, many other people, many, many other branches of the House of York and Lancaster who would have a better claim. And anyway, but Henry VI doesn't despise his half-brother, Edmund Tudor. He doesn't sort of exile him or put him in prison or have him killed or try and pretend he doesn't exist or any of that. He's married. He's part of the royal family, basically, right? And he's married off to some noble woman, Margaret Beaufort. The Beaufort family are extremely rich and powerful and important. He's married off to her. And they have a baby in the end. She's very young, Margaret Beaufort. Very, very young. I think she's like 14 or something. 13 or something when she has a baby by Edmund Tudor, and they call that son Henry. He is Henry the Seventh. Okay, so bear all that in mind. The king's mother, Catherine of Valois, is sort of very, very important, even though you probably won't mention her all that much in this episode. Okay, I'll just jump straight in then. I'll start reading from Charles Oman, Professor Sir Charles Oman. And he says this, quote, "England had never yet had a sovereign of such tender age as the infant king who succeeded to the heritage of Henry V. It was under the rule of a child of less than 12 months old that the long and wearisome French war had to be continued." Because, as I said, Henry V was right in the middle of campaigns in France, right in the middle of it. He's got two brothers, Gloucester and Bedford, who will play important roles. But nonetheless, the actual crown passes to a baby. Yet at first, the prospects of the reign did not look very dark. They do get dark. But Oman says, at first, it looks okay. The struggle in France was not going ill. The English were still winning. Joan of Arc hadn't happened yet. And seldom had any orphan had so zealous and capable a guardian by his cradle as John of Bedford, the little king's eldest uncle. He had, moreover, no domestic intrigues to fear. Edmund, Earl of March. As I said, there were many other families or branches of the family which might have claimed to be the rightful king. Remember, Henry the Fourth, that's Henry the Fifth's father, this little baby Henry the Sixth's grandfather, had been basically a usurper, hadn't he? He'd had Richard the Second put in prison and then he mysteriously died. Many people said that this House of Lancaster are simply the wrong family to rule. So all that's still going on. Everything was okay whilst Henry V lived because nobody could really challenge him for the crown because he's so powerful and successful on the battlefield. But now there's a little baby in charge. Perhaps these families, well, it will all come to a head, but not right away. Oman tells us Edmund, Earl of March, the legitimate heir of Richard II, was the most unenterprising and loyal of men and never gave any trouble. On his deathbed, Henry V had not appointed his eldest and most capable brother, John, Duke of Bedford, to be the regent in England, as might have been expected. His ruling passion was strong in death, and he thought above all things of the maintenance of the English ascendancy in France. Therefore, he named Duke John to take charge of the government in that country, i.e. France. As regent of England, he designated his younger brother, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, a man of far less worth and weight. The Parliament, however, the Parliament of England, held that the king could not dispose of the regency by will, Henry V. He couldn't just say that, he couldn't just do that. And though they named Gloucester Protector, a type of Lord Protector, or a type of regent, they placed many limitations on his power. Unfortunately, they could not remedy his reckless and flighty disposition. During the whole long minority of Henry VI, his childhood, that's a way of saying childhood, his long minority of Henry VI, the varying fortunes of the French war were almost the only topic that stirred the interest of the nation. The internal history of England is well nigh a blank. No period since the conquest of William the Conqueror, well over 400 years ago, 400 odd years ago, is left so bare by the chroniclers, who seem to have no eyes or ears for anything save the fate of our armies across the Channel. The quarrels of Duke Humphrey with his colleagues in the Regency are the only other topic on which they touch. The council carried out the policy of the late king, so far as any body of statesmen of average ability can continue the work of a single man of high military and political genius. They strained every nerve to keep up the war in France and subordinated every other end to that purpose. Their wisest act was the release of the young King of Scots after 17 years of captivity. Seeing that his kinsman Albany was helping the French, they set James I free and sent him home. He married, ere he departed, Joan Beaufort, daughter of the Earl of Somerset, and granddaughter of John of Gaunt, a lady for whom he had formed a romantic attachment in the days of his captivity. See, the Beaufort family are very, very important and close to the throne. By her influence, it was hoped that he would be kept firm in the English alliance. In some degree, this hope was fulfilled. James promptly slew his cousins of Albany and devoted himself to pacifying and bringing back into order the country from which he had been so long exiled. We must now turn to the aspect of affairs beyond the Channel, the subject which seemed all important to the English nation at this time. The old mad King of France had died only 2 months after his son-in-law, Henry V. Yeah, had Henry V lived just a few months longer, he would have been the king of both England and France. Yeah, it was a really inopportune moment, almost the worst possible moment for Henry V to have contracted dysentery and died. And we're told that the old King of France died in October 1422. Bedford had, therefore, to proclaim his little nephew as king at Paris and to rule in his name, no longer in that of the unhappy Charles VI. That's the old mad king. The Dauphin, i.e. the legitimate, until very recently disinherited, the legitimate heir to the Kingdom of France. The Dauphin also assumed the title of King of France. Okay, so straight away, two people are claiming to be the King of France. Both the English claiming this little baby, Henry VI, is, and the grown-up heir, legit heir, to be honest, the Dauphin, was also claiming it. And he was acknowledged as monarch in all the lands south of the Loire, i.e. most of France stood behind him, as you can expect. But he was an indolent and apathetic young man, governed entirely by his favourites, and wholly unskilled and averse to military enterprises. He did so little for himself, and seemed so contented with his unsatisfactory position, that men called him in scorn the King of Bruges, his residence for the time, rather than the King of France. End quote. Okay, so let me switch over now to Churchill. And he has a bit more of a sweeping introduction to his segment about Henry VI. And I think it's very interesting. One section here is particularly very good, I think. But let me just read from this. Churchill tells us, quote, "As Henry VI grew up, his virtues and simpleness became equally apparent. He was not entirely docile. In 1431, when he was 10 years old, Warwick, his preceptor, reported that he was grown in years, in stature of his person, and also in conceit and knowledge of his royal estate, and causes him to grudge any chastising." So Churchill jumped straight in with an overall assessment of Henry. "The council had, in his childhood, made a great show of him, brought him to ceremonies, and crowned him with solemnity both in London and Paris. As time passed, they became naturally inclined to keep him under stricter control. His consequence was maintained by the rivalry of the nobles," i.e. when you've got a little boy that's a king or an emperor, the real power lies with whoever controls him, right? Whoever brings him up. When he's still an infant or even just a boy, can't really wield any power or authority of his own, the people that control him do. So that's the key. And so you would fight over that. You could have civil wars over just that. "A body of knights and squires had for some years been appointed to dwell with him and to be his servants. As the disastrous years in France unfolded, he was pressed continually to assert himself. At 15, he was already regularly attending council meetings. He was allowed to exercise a measure of prerogative in pardons and rewards. When the council differed, it was agreed he should decide. He often played the part of mediator by compromise. Before he was 18, he had absorbed himself in the foundation of his colleges at Eton and at Cambridge. He was thought by the high nobles to take a precocious and unhealthy interest in public affairs, which neither his wisdom nor experience could sustain." So here's the question of whether he was clever and wise or an idiot. I'll let Churchill continue. He says this: "He showed a feebleness of mind and spirit and a gentleness of nature which were little suited to the fierce rivalries of a martial age. Opinion and also interests were divided upon him. Flattering accounts of his remarkable intelligence were matched by other equally biased tales that he was an idiot almost incapable of distinguishing between right and wrong. Modern historians confirm the less complimentary view. At the hour when a strong king alone could recreate the balance between the nation and the nobility, when all demanded the restraint of faction at home and the waging of victorious war without undue expense abroad, the throne was known to be occupied by a devout simpleton, suited alike by his qualities and defects to be a puppet." End quote. So Churchill, and as Churchill says there, most historians agree that he was, you know, I suppose in modern days you might say he had learning difficulties. I'm not sure if it went that far. He was literate. He could read and write. He wasn't a true simpleton. You know, I mean, do we even use that word anymore? Simpleton. But whatever it was, it seems that he wasn't massively quick-witted. He was sort of apparently slow of speech, slow of thought in some way. Well, in fact, as he gets older, and we'll get to this in time, in adulthood, definitely suffered, definitely, 100%. Suffered from mental illness, severe mental illness later in life. So there was a real imbalance, sort of a chemical imbalance in his mind. Then sort of must have been very, very difficult to tell what diseases people had in history. And it's even more difficult to diagnose any sort of mental illness, exactly what it was. Impossible, really. But if the accounts are to be believed, Henry VI certainly had suffered from a mental illness, even a severe mental illness. And it seems he would have got that from his mother. Remember, his mother was Catherine of Valois, Catherine of France, and her father, so Henry VI's maternal grandfather, was the Mad King of France, who also definitely suffered from some sort of mental illness. So it seems that passed down through the family. Okay, Churchill goes on saying, "There were evil days ahead for England. The crown was beggarly, the nobles rich. The people were unhappy and unrestful rather than unprosperous. The religious issues of an earlier century were now dominated by more practical politics. The empire so swiftly gained upon the continent," by what Henry V had just won in the last generation, "was being cast away by an incompetent and self-enriching oligarchy, and the revenues which might have sent irresistible armies to beat the French were engrossed by the church." We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.